Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast.
You're listening to the show from KJZZ with help from our friends of the world. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody. The Federal Environmental Protection Agency says in 2013, carbon dioxide accounted for more than 80% of all U.S. greenhouse gas emissions from human activities. But researchers at ASU are working on a way to take CO2 out of the air. Klaus Lochner is the director of the University Center for Negative Carbon Emissions.
One thing you could do is you could grow a lot of trees, a lot of biomass, and then burn it and deal with the CO2 and dispose of it. We are arguing the most direct way and a faster way of dealing with the problem is to take the CO2 just like a tree, but more efficiently out of the air.
So how do you do that?
Well, we have developed, or discovered is probably the better word, a material which has the remarkable property that if it's dry, it really likes CO2, it binds it, and when you make it wet in a closed box, it will release that CO2 and give it back. So as a result, we can stand out here in the nice desert air in the sunshine, and as the wind blows over our leaves of an artificial tree, so to speak, the CO2 binds to these surfaces, then we gather them, put them in a box, make them wet, and then the CO2 comes off at a few percent CO2 in the gas mixture which comes out of that box. We now can feed this to algae, or we could collect it and turn it into mineral carbonates and put it permanently and safely away. The third option is we could have sunshine on a photovoltaic panel which makes electricity. With that electricity, we break up water and make hydrogen. With that hydrogen and CO2, we can make fuel again. So we close the cycle that way.
So what is this material that it sounds like it's basically like a magnet for carbon dioxide?
Your classical magnet for carbon dioxide is a sodium hydroxide solution or even a sodium carbonate solution. If you put CO2 over those solutions, you can collect CO2. What we have is the same idea inside a plastic.
How would you go about deploying these? I mean, what would they look like? Where would you put them? How many would you need?
Well, we like to think about them as ultimately factory produced because we know, let's say, from building cars, how effective it is to mass produce, how cheap things can get if you do this. And so we see containerized units, so they fit in a standard shipping container, and they can probably in the end pull out about 1 ton per day. And if you had that many and you wanted to deal with all the CO2 we create right now, which is unlikely that we do it that way, but if you did, you would need 100 million of them. Keep in mind, we have a billion cars parked somewhere, so that number is large, but not as large as that it's prohibitive.
Do you think that philosophically, is there almost kind of a danger in this kind of technology that if people think, well, it doesn't matter how much I emit because these machines can just take it out of the atmosphere and it won't matter what I do?
Well, I've thought about that a lot. I think the first answer is you could have told me this in 1980. And I would have agreed with you. Right now, you're telling me to fight a very big problem with one hand tied behind my back. In a way, I think it's already too late. It's very likely that we will reach a level in the atmosphere which is higher than we can afford. So we need this technology. Now, whether it will lead people to say, well, now we can keep using the carbon dioxide, at the very least, I can come back and say it didn't cause climate change because we actually did balance the books. And I can leave it to the markets to figure out what is right. On the other hand, keep in mind, putting that CO2 away will cost money, and you will actually emphasize technologies which avoid doing it in the first place. Right? I'm not supposed to put my garbage right on the street and scatter it everywhere, and that's effectively what we do with CO2. And I think we are still thinking about carbon dioxide as something, oh, if we did less of it, it's a good thing. You wouldn't think of this with my waste. If I say I figured out how to only dump half of my garbage onto the street, you wouldn't think that's a good idea, right? You would say that half still has to be put away. Of course, because it costs money to put it in the landfill, I'm now very much paying attention of making less waste. And I think that's how we have to think about CO2.
Klaus Lackner is director of ASU's Center for Negative Carbon Emissions. Klaus, thank you.
You're welcome.
The valley's monsoon storms can feature sky-blasting lightning, earth-shaking thunder, and walls of dust. Some people just turn up the volume on the TV to block out the storms, but many others go toward the activity, hoping to capture it on their cameras and phones. Brian Snyder is a storm chaser and weather documentarian who gets especially excited about the monsoon. Brian, what are you seeing when you see the storm? Do you say to yourself, I want to make this look a certain way to help people who see the photo feel the way I do experiencing it in person?
I always have kind of a personal goal, which has been kind of founded by a friend of mine. His name's Larry Reeves, and he said, go out and find landscapes that happen to have weather. So when I see, you know, lightning pop up on a radar or different things like that, I see that as an opportunity to capture Arizona in a very unique way. You know, a lot of people think of Arizona as being a hot, dry, you know, desert wasteland. And when I can capture our landscapes, which I think are awesome, beautiful, that happen to have weather, then I think I get two elements that people don't expect.
Is it more exciting to shoot when there's, I mean, you're talking about the beautiful landscape, so is it more exciting for you to shoot when there's something really actively going on?
As a storm chaser and a storm photographer, we all, you know, mark our calendars for June 15th when the monsoon actually officially begins. But I think it's just one of those things that, you know, this time of year is special because, you know, most of the time there's not a cloud in the sky. So if you go to the Grand Canyon, even if you're not seeing a massive lightning storm, there's still clouds. It creates shadows. It creates lots of different opportunities to capture, you know, a magnificent landscape like the Grand Canyon that you normally wouldn't get to see, you know, other parts of the year.
How far are you willing to go, Brian, as far as like, are you willing to go from one side of town to the other to make sure you get the shot?
Oh, yeah. Last 3 days, I've driven probably close to 1,500 miles. You know, you got to be willing. Kind of the mindset that I have is, you know, back in January, would I be willing to drive out to the East Valley to capture lightning? And the answer would be yes. So during the monsoon, if it means I got to constantly drive, you know, 1,500 miles to capture weather, then that's what I'm going to do.
Yeah. As you said, the monsoon can vary through yes. parts of the area. But I'm wondering, are there certain places where you go, if the monsoon's going on, boy, it's hard to not take a great shot?
I find that the farming fields just around Eloy or, you know, Coolidge offer a unique landscape because it's almost like if I show somebody a picture, they look and say, oh, that looks like the Midwest. Of course, I'm going to see a thunderstorm. But then they see mountains behind it, and it kind of throws them a curveball because it looks like Kansas, but yet it's not. And so I find kind of those areas are fun to shoot, and there's usually, you know, frequent weather down there, or at least there's a good chance. But also, I think northern Arizona offers a very unique opportunity to shoot Arizona. I love, you know, kind of the I-40 corridor between Winslow and Flagstaff. I think that's always has produced some pretty good results for me as well.
They're probably all your babies to some extent, but there are a couple either photos you've shot or aspects of a film you've shot where you were just like, I'm so glad I got this because this is one of those that seemed unique or I might never be able to catch something like this again.
Actually, a couple of days ago, you know, it was probably my 10th, 11th, 12th time of going to the Grand Canyon to capture a storm. And unfortunately, I've only had a one-hit wonder there. That was the very first time, July 5th, 2013, I captured a lightning bolt into the Grand Canyon at sunset. And that's just been an image in my mind that I replay over and over again because I know how long I had to wait to get that. Mm-hmm. But I also know how I've tried and tried so many times afterwards to not have any success whatsoever up there. And so that's an image that I'm really proud of just because, you know, I captured an iconic Arizona landscape.
Brian Snyder is a storm chaser, also a weather documentarian. Brian, thanks for coming in.
Hey, no problem. Thank you.
It's the show on 91.5. Thanks for listening. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody.
Elefante, melodic to say and hard to explain. It's the name of a hand-built residence, a collection of buildings and sculptures 2 hours north of Phoenix. Its construction began more than 30 years ago as a painter's vision. He's now dead, but as KJZZ's Stina Sieg found out, his creation lives on, tucked away off a residential street in the tiny town of Cornville.
People say you can't put Elefante into words. You just have to be there. So here I am, headed down an overgrown, winding path on a 4-acre lot, lined with fake grass, beaten down by decades of sun and feet.
Yeah, this place does look like a mini golf course of sorts, except for more strange.
Cole Lati is the unofficial Elefante ambassador, who takes me past amorphous sculptures and little shacks drenched in color, and to Ryan Mattson, Elefante's executive director for nearly 6 years. He's one of a half dozen caretakers in their 20s and 30s that live on site in a small village of vintage trailers.
We bring a little bit of youth culture to Elefante.
And Mattson says they're continuing what painter Michael Kahn and his wife Lita Levant Kahn started here on the lush banks of Oak Creek more than 30 years ago. It's beautiful and shaded and used to be mistaken as public land before its owners asked the couple to be caretakers.
It was just a handshake.
Which grew into a tangle of structures made by two people with no architectural experience or plans, just spontaneous creativity.
It sort of unfolded from their minds or extended off of their canvas.
Oh, wow.
Notice the temperature gets very comfortable in here.
Yeah.
Half of the building is buried underground.
We're walking under the vaulted ceiling of Hippodome, which Mattson thinks of as the heart of Elefante. I want to say it looks like something, a colorful ear canal maybe? But the domed cathedral-like structure is a hodgepodge of so many things. Stacked rocks on the wall, a carpet mosaic on the floor, shiny mylar on the ceiling. Mattson says you couldn't get away with building something like this now.
Well, none of this was built to be resold. This was just built to live in. And it really became that extension of their heart.
That's a tradition Mattson and a core group of Elefante believers want to continue. They've spent the last few years raising awareness and money enough to purchase the land outright. Their mission? Explaining to the public why Elefante matters. Something co-creator Lita Levant Kahn puts this way.
Because it's the creative pulse that's working there, and that never stops.
People would tell her the place inspired them to change all the colors in their own home or throw out their furniture and build new pieces themselves.
I mean, but everybody was so excited.
And that excitement can still be felt. Back at Elefante, darkness has fallen over a monthly celebration of Elefante lovers. Jerome resident Jessica Laurel Reese is sitting underneath a wonderland of trees, sparkling with tiny projected lights.
I mean, there's a different resonance here. There's like this, you know, hyper creative, really beautiful whimsy everywhere. And I think that kind of follows you out of here.
And maybe nudges you to create something beautiful and strange and free of rules in your own life. Stina Sieg, KJZZ News, reporting from Elefante.
The traditions of Native American music have been evident in American pop music for a century or more, but we may not notice or even realize those influences. That's part of what drove Jeff Berglund to be one of the editors of the new book, Indigenous Pop, Native American Music from Jazz to Hip Hop. He's also an English professor at Northern Arizona University, and he joins me. Jeff, how far back can we go in hearing these influences?
I would make a case that you can go back earlier to very local instances where anyone with access to instrumentation was making innovations and borrowing traditions of popular forms, you know, from their neighbors if they were in neighboring tribal communities, or flash forward post-colonization and post-contact where people were learning and borrowing from various traditions.
How would we define what Native American music is? Are there certain instruments we would naturally think of, certain types of sounds we'd naturally think of?
Well, I think, you know, listeners in the Southwest might typically be thinking of instrumentation that's linked to two primary instruments, the flute and the drum. I would say that singers are as crucial, if not more crucial, than any type of instrumentation within the history of indigenous music. And if we think about the role of music within indigenous communities, we have to think about it being a pervasive part of any daily or ritual life of indigenous peoples.
Is there a particularly strong era, what many would call more the protest era, maybe primarily in the 60s, though obviously not exclusively to the 60s, and when there was such a big push with folk music?
It's definitely a strong period, and I think that we saw a convergence of a number of things in the U.S. in particular. In terms of the civil rights era and other social movements, including the Red Power movement, we saw the rise in profile of singer-songwriters who could give voice to, you know, messages from so-called Indian country, from indigenous perspectives. So in our book, we feature a number of chapters that focus on folk singers such as Buffy St. Marie.
I learned a safety rule. I don't know who to thank. Don't stand between the reservation and the corporate bank. They'll send in federal tanks. It isn't nice, but it's reality. Bury my heart in wounded knee.
Country western singers that kind of transcend that. The line between folk and country western, a singer such as Floyd Crow Westerman. We also look at the continuing folk tradition, so the line of influence from those two figures from the 1960s, 1970s, you know, has been, the line of influence has been significant.
Is there a possibility for a renaissance of this sort of thing, Jeff, considering how much our society is even more focused on our changing demographics, how much more diverse we're becoming as a society?
I think there's definitely a renaissance, and it's in part because of the ascendancy of social media. It becomes so much easier for musicians to get their music out there through SoundCloud, through YouTube. So you have the opportunity for small fan bases to become much bigger, much more quickly. MTV ran a special fairly recently on the range of Native musicians, you know, that are participating in multiple traditions from hip-hop to rap to reggae, punk, and so forth. The National Museum of the American Indian, a Smithsonian museum, had an exhibit fairly recently on this subject.
Jeff, we could talk about a lot more. I'm just going to ask you one more question, though, and it's a name that is probably more mainstream for a lot of folks, and someone who actually has Native American background but also was a pop musician,
yeah.
And that's Robbie Robertson of the band.
Perhaps you think the Creator sent you here to dispose of us as you see fit. If I thought you were sent by the Creator, I might be induced to think you had a right to dispose of me. Do not misunderstand me, but understand me fully with reference to my affection for the land.
His Mohawk identity was always a component of his identity, but whether it was a part of his public profile was another matter altogether. And definitely as he, you know, gained both notoriety and critical acclaim and was, you know, had negotiating power within the industry, he developed a different sensibility about sharing parts of that identity through his music in a public way.
Northern Arizona University English professor Jeff Berglund, he's also the co-editor of the new book, Indigenous Pop, Native American Music from Jazz to Hip Hop.
We want to hear from you. Let us know what you think. Let us know about good story ideas. We're at the show at kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the show. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody. Have a great afternoon.
This is member-supported KJZZ FM Phoenix and HD.
That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.